No longer are finances to be an insurmountable barrier, nor the fact that you can't qualify for other scholarships. If you're willing to work hard, we're willing to invest in you.
Governor Parnell proposes a program to send more high school students to college. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 6th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, second-year ice grows in the Arctic.
The ice pack might become a little more robust now. They'd be able to take a little bit of a better punch next summer.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Elks National Foundation, in conjunction with the Alaska State Elks Association and local lodges, is offering the Most Valuable Student MVS Scholarship for high school seniors. These scholarships are awarded to graduating high school seniors through a local, state, and national competition and are based on scholarship, leadership, and financial need. Information and applications at elks.org/ENF. Application deadline is November 2nd. This message sponsored by the Alaska Elks Association.
Governor Parnell wants to make a college education available to more Alaskans. In a speech to Anchorage High School students today, he proposed a scholarship program that would pay as much as 100% of tuition costs for students at any university or job training center in the state. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Governor Parnell told students at Anchorage's West High School that they need to be sharper, that more of them need to stay in school to graduate and be ready for secondary education. In presenting the governor's performance scholarship program, he called it a way of guaranteeing their futures.
It's for those students who want to work hard, move their lives forward, change their direction, and just keep advancing forward. So with some hard work, we're willing to invest in you beyond high school. We're willing to give you that chance to make it if you're willing to invest more of yourself and stay in school. No longer are finances to be an insurmountable barrier, nor the fact that you can't qualify for other scholarships. If you're willing to work hard, we're willing to invest in you.
The program would pay 100% of tuition costs for every graduate with an A average, 75% for those with B averages, and 50% for those with a C-plus average. Based on merit, those payments would go to students from any Alaska high school who's taken 4 years of math, language arts, and science, plus 3 years of social studies. They could attend any university or job training institution in the state. The average tuition cost for a student at the University of Alaska this year is $4,500, and increases have been approved that will jump that expense to more than $5,000 in the fall of 2011. The university's current scholarship program, Alaska Scholars, is available to those who graduate in the top 10% of their high school classes, and it pays the first $11,000 in tuition costs. The governor says the funds for the scholarship would come from the earnings of $400 million he wants the legislature to set aside during next year's session.
I don't want the scholarships to be a drain on the general fund and to detract from education funding or public safety or anything like that. So in fact, 20, 30 years from now, the state should still have that $400 million, but we'll have a better trained, better educated workforce.
Getting the program through the legislature might be a heavy task, though. House Finance Co-Chair Mike Hawker was not briefed on the program in advance. He says the announcement leaves a lot of questions unanswered. He raises the question of finding $400 million at the same time lawmakers are looking for $1 billion for local schools next year. He also needs a definition of a high school graduate, one that transferred in at the end of his senior year, or one that had been in Alaska for 4 years. Hawker says he'll have hearings on the program, but he's not ready to predict an outcome until he gets answers to his long list of questions.
What is the program really going to be about? How is it going to be paid for? What is it really projected to cost into the future? And will it really accomplish the goal of education in this state, which is certainly to help students, but remembering that not all students pursue vocational or collegiate education? Is it a fair program?
Hawker says he'll also wait to see what other priorities are on the legislature's agenda for next year's session. For example, he says meeting the energy needs of South Central residents will be a much higher priority for him. Parnell says 22 other states have merit-based scholarship systems, but he expects the details he's now preparing will change through the legislative process. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The latest data on Arctic sea ice shows thicker second-year ice has grown, but scientists say the Arctic is still likely on its way to ice-free summers. A new study out today confirms that summer 2009 had the third lowest ice cover in the 30 years since satellite record-keeping began, but it also shows longer-lasting second-year ice is substantially greater than it has been in recent years. Second-year ice has survived two summers of melting and is stronger and thicker than new ice. The research comes from the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado. Director and senior scientist Mark Serez says it does show improvement in retaining ice.
What we saw at the end of this summer is that we had a pretty good survival rate of this first-year ice, which has now going to become this thicker second-year ice. So it's saying that, the ice pack might become a little more robust now, maybe able to take a little bit of a better punch next summer. But we're just in a waiting mode now to see what happens.
Serez cautions that the increase in second-year ice does not mean the Arctic has ceased its trend of rapid melt.
I don't think we're looking at a long-term recovery. If you look at the time series of September ice extent from year to year to year, what you see is that while you definitely have this steep overall decline, it's a very spiky time series. There's a lot of ups and downs and ups and downs and ups and downs.
The National Snow and Ice Data Center research done in September shows second-year ice made up 32% of the ice mass, compared to only 9% last year and 21% in 2007. But the amount of ice cover over 2 years old was the lowest ever since satellite record-keeping began. Serez says this summer was on pace to rival the overall record low of sea ice of 2007.
But then along comes August and a bit of a cooler, cloudier pattern set up in the Arctic. And that helped us to preserve some of the ice, give us a little bit less melt. So in a sense, we were sort of saved by the bell. Now, we can't be hoping that that's going to continue forever. So, well, it's nice to see a little bit of a recovery. I'm not all that optimistic that it's going to be continuing.
In the past 30 years, ice extent has declined at a rate of more than 11% per decade during September. The latest population data for the Cook Inlet beluga whale shows the species is still declining. Biologists estimate there are 321 whales this year, down from 375 in 2007 and 2008. It's the third lowest estimate since 1994. Barbara Mahoney is a biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service. She says overall, the population has fallen about 1.5% per year.
It just reinforces that our data that shows the gradual that the population is gradually declining. So we're working on making protective and measures conservation efforts to eventually recover and have the population start to increase.
The Cook Inlet beluga was listed as an endangered species in October 2008. NIMFS is currently working on a proposal to designate critical habitat that should be released by the end of the month and will be followed by public hearings and a public comment period. The final rule will be released next fall. Brad Smith is working on the proposal. He says critical habitat will include areas in the inlet the whales rely on to find food and raise their young. He says once the habitat is set, it won't put an end to development.
The designation of critical habitat doesn't carry with it any prohibitions or restrictions like you might find with designating an area as a wilderness or a park. It only obligates a federal agency who are proposing to conduct any work or permit any activities within that critical habitat to consult with National Marine Fisheries Service on whether or not their work is going to impact the critical habitat for these whales.
Smith says the agency will also start work on a recovery plan for the species beginning next year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the drama and heartbreak of championship high school football.
At home, you know, a big crowd, and your last home game ever, win or lose, it's your last time playing on this field.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Litsite Alaska is a web community for families, teachers, librarians, health professionals, and Alaskans of all ages. There are thousands of pages with everything from Alaska's digital archives to kids' games, information about the state's history, culture, narrative, and healing.
Teachers love Litsite, Alaska. You can discover Litsite, Alaska at LITSITE.org. Litsite, Alaska is a project of the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
After several months of coordination and assistance, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, FEMA, is closing down their operation that began on June 14th in response to the devastating spring floods on the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. Their main base of operation was set up in a three-story building near the Anchorage Airport. FEMA spokesman Jack Heesch says at the height of operations, there were about 160 FEMA workers assisting in the state.
In this case, we've got people from Washington, Oregon, but some as far away as the Carolinas or Florida. You know, we're all what we call disaster assistance employees. We're reservists. We only work when there's a disaster that needs our assistance. And you get a phone call and you're expected to travel within 24 to 48 hours. And in a lot of cases, of course, like this, we were anticipating it.
Heesch says FEMA tries to be more forward-thinking in their planning for disaster assistance now. He says the federal coordinating officer in charge, Doug Main, gave a directive that he wanted smoke coming out of chimneys in Eagle before snow flew. Eagle resident and rebuild construction team coordinator Andy Basich says that goal was met.
We built 13 homes, and people are now living in all but, I think, two of them, and that's just their choice at this point in time. And we actually completed two other buildings to the point where with maybe another week's worth of work, we may be able to have the people into them. So all in all, a very good, successful plan, and the cleanup operation went very well, too.
Heesch says FEMA handled replacement requests from villages that ranged from small pieces of equipment to large infrastructure.
One of the villages lost its lawnmower. And so, you know, what's the cost to replace a lawnmower? Well, in a place like Kuitluck, I don't know, probably a few hundred bucks, to something as big as the Utilidor in Monick, which may cost as much as $3 million.
Louise Lopez is the public assistance officer for the Alaska Flood Response. She lives in Washington State and works at the main FEMA regional headquarters there, but she's been in Alaska most of the summer and won't leave until later this month. She says FEMA worked hard at being flexible to address the difficult logistics that are unique to Alaskan communities that have marginal or no road access.
So if it really costs 50% of the total cost of repair just to barge, you know, like barging gravel and things like that, it's gravel's like gold in Alaska. And so we have to look at all those costs and figure out what the true costs are so that they're not shorted.
Lopez says more than 200 charter flights were scheduled to move people around to the various sites throughout the spring and summer.
I put a team of people in Bethel that worked out of Bethel and went and was working on the Lower Kusk. And then I had a team in Fairbanks. And so they were right there so that they could travel back and forth as quickly as possible, not stationed out of Anchorage, so they'd be more accessible.
The final tally will be in excess of $20 million for infrastructure expense in 28 villages and around $7 million for individual assistance. Eagle's Basich says Samaritan's Purse and the Mennonite Disaster Service helped things get built quickly. The road to Eagle officially closes, or at least is no longer maintained by Alaska DOT, just 10 days from now on October 16th. A state senator's fishing citation is spilling over into deliberations of Southeast's oldest Native organization. The Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood hold their annual convention this week in Juneau. A key topic is the state's role in subsistence. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
State wildlife troopers cited Senator Albert Kukesh and three other people near Angoon in July for exceeding the catch allowed by their subsistence permits. Officers accused them of harvesting too many sockeye salmon in a beach seine. Kukesh says they were following the traditional practice of catching fish for the community, and he says the total allowed should have included permits of others involved in the effort who were not on the scene when officers arrived. Alaska Native Brotherhood Grand Camp President Bradley Flitch says others have faced similar situations.
By no means is that the only incident that has occurred in the past few months or past last year. It's actually a pattern of the state.
Kukesh is challenging the state's role in subsistence enforcement. That issue is on the agenda of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood's Grand Camp Convention. That's the annual meeting of the organization's regional body, which has chapters throughout Southeast. Flitch says members have been drafting resolutions that could influence the organization's subsistence stance.
I've seen a couple of the resolutions, and they're very, very strong. And hopefully we can clearly articulate what the issue is, what the needs are, and how they should be resolved, both from the state and the federal perspective.
But that's just one part of the week-long meeting held at the Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall in Juneau. The convention's theme borrows a phrase from Barack Obama's presidential campaign. It's Yes, We Can, Cultural Unity Through Communication and Education. Flitch says that includes updates on using contemporary technologies.
Facebook, Twitter, email. Just how can we use these new technologies to get our grassroots story out to the general public, and then also improve our internal communications.
The convention is also focusing on how the region's different Native groups can work together better. Flitch says that ties into the event's theme.
And the idea is, how do we use these things through education and communication to really strengthen and unify the various Native entities, all of which are AMB Grand Camp's children or grandchildren.
Many tribal health, business, and government organizations grew out of early Native rights efforts begun by members of the ANB. The organization is close to 100 years old. Grand Camp officials and host Camp 70 in Juneau hope to extend their Yes We Can theme by inviting First Lady Michelle Obama to be the keynote speaker. She wasn't available. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
The University of Alaska Anchorage is going through a growth spurt with new buildings popping up on campus. One building in particular catches the eye because of its unusual appearance. The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program's home base is shaped like a Haida canoe. Young Alaska Native students are flocking to the program. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has the story as part of our ongoing series on Native education.
And I've been working at Dow for the past year as a civil engineering intern.
About 100 students are gathered in the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program's main computer lab for the weekly pizza meeting. Empty pizza boxes litter the floor. Students munch on pepperoni and veggie slices, but all eyes are on Jen Montgomery's PowerPoint presentation.
So I'm going to talk to you about fire approval. We are required to apply for fire approval.
It's a working lunch. An ANSEP executive director, Herb Schroeder, is there counting heads and making sure it's all running smoothly. He says the students are sharing a lot more than pizza and information.
The students don't need me so much, they need each other. So what we do is we provide opportunities for the students to network and make friends so that they can study together, they can face the challenges that they're going to face in the next 4 or 5 years while they're studying to get their degrees together.
It's one of the new ways of serving Alaska Native students in a manner that makes them comfortable in a college setting.
It's a fundamental part of the culture that everything is done as a team. It's easy to work with Natives in teams because everything's community. And what I say is community is more important than the individual. So that, we'll team up a group of students to go take a physics class together, and then they all study together.
The building has a utilitarian design, but with lots of open space and plenty of Native art adorning the walls. Schroeder says there's even a dance floor for traditional dancing.
We chose the shape of a canoe because it's a thing that all traditional peoples use, actually all around the world. It's used for getting from one place to another, and it's a place of safety. The students that come in here and study are coming from the life they're at and going to this new professional life in science and engineering.
Not bad for a professor who started with only one student 10 years ago. Even 5 years back, none of this existed. But Schroeder set three goals for a native engineering program at UAA.
And the first one was that our students would have a place on campus, a place where they could come, a place of belonging. Then our second goal was that we would have always have a professor on the campus who was an advocate for our students. And the third sustainability goal is scholarship funding.
There is no requirement of Native heritage to enroll in the program, but since 2002, ANSEP has graduated 149 Alaska Native engineering students. Students like Dillingham's Mike Andrew, an ANSEP junior, is looking ahead.
Hopefully get a job for one of the local engineering firms here and stay in Alaska.
And that's why Schroeder started ANSEP, to provide opportunities for Alaska Natives for jobs. Some grads will go back to rural villages and work on sanitation and water systems, some to the oil fields. Others may go into teaching, something Schroeder says will eventually dispel an enduring and erroneous belief that Alaska Native students have no appetite for math or science.
There aren't enough teachers to go around to teach the college preparatory coursework that you need. And if you're going to do science and engineering, you need chemistry, physics, and trigonometry.
Schroeder says the real hurdle is low expectations. The deeply rooted belief that Native students can't is something Schroeder relishes in disproving. To recruit students, ANSEP staff take computer components to high school kids in the villages. They teach the kids to build their own computers and then use them to take distance college prep courses.
And what we're finding is that something more than 60% of the students who build computers will complete all three of those classes before they graduate high school. So there's a huge motivating effect and a steam-building effect with the computers that pushes the kids right through.
ANSEP is working with some 400 high school students this way.
We're opening the doors and windows of possibilities of a career in engineering and science. These are things that weren't open 20 years ago.
The change will come about as more students move through the system and demonstrate that Alaska Natives can take professional jobs, Schroeder says. Senior Brian Glasheen is proof. He'll graduate from ANSEP at the end of the year and has a job with a major company already waiting for him.
I found out about ANSEP through high school because they actually came out to Bethel, so I was one of the few kids from the bush. Just kind of started it off, and then I kind of started recruiting some of my friends to come in. Just a great program, great way of networking. It's most likely the reason I have the job and where I'm going forward now. I mean, I consider it to be definitely a huge catalyst.
Schroeder, for his part, has received national recognition for his work. The National Action Council for Minorities in Engineering gave him its 2009 Founders Award in September. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
More Native education stories, pictures, and links are at our website, APRN.org. Juneau High School athletes will be subject to random drug tests beginning October 19th. The Juneau School Board last night voted unanimously to implement a mandatory drug testing program for all high school sports, cheerleading squads, and the dance and drill team. Regulations are being developed for voluntary testing of other students. The program includes high school drug education classes and training for teachers, staff, coaches, and parents. The tests will reveal the use of a number of drugs, including nicotine, alcohol, oxycodone, and other opiates, methamphetamine, cocaine, and pot. Students who test positive will not be allowed to participate in their sport for the remainder of the season. They can ask for a retest. Throughout the process, the board has heard from hundreds of people asking for a school drug testing program. JDHS site council chair Terry Tibbett says the intent is to change the high school culture.
To see the prevention element be really strongly implemented.
The new program is expected to cost the Juneau School District about $220,000 per year. Forget the Vikings against the Packers. The real football drama this week is taking place at high school fields across the state. The championship series is underway to determine the top team for small and large schools. In Juneau over the weekend, the Crimson Bears lost to the Chugiak Mustangs in a heartbreaker. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander from member station KTOO was there.
The stands were supercharged with a couple of thousand loyal Juneau fans and a small but very vocal group from Chugiak. Mustang head coach Duncan Shackelford called Juneau a great football atmosphere.
And I told the kids all week, you're blessed to come down and play in this kind of environment because these are what kids down the states play with all the time.
Late in the third quarter, the score was tied at 14-all. Juneau's Matthew Maka appeared to have scored on an 8-yard run ending at the goal line pylon. But a holding penalty against Juneau nullified the touchdown and the ball was placed on the Mustangs' 15. A pass from Philip Fanumiai to Lawrence Fanumiai put the ball on the 2. Another passing attempt was incomplete when the intended receiver was hit hard by two Chugiak defenders just as he touched the ball. Options were to kick a field goal or advance the ball from scrimmage. The Bears elected to run the ball. They were unsuccessful, and Chugiak took over on their 1-yard line. The fourth quarter found the Crimson Bears deep in their end of the field. They were unable to advance the ball and were forced to punt. A false start penalty against the Bears placed punter Silver Maki on the goal line. The snap from center was out of Maki's reach and the ball bounced out of the end zone, giving Chugiak a safety and 2 points with 3 seconds on the clock. The score was Chugiak 16, Juneau 14. The game was over. Chugiak quarterback Chris Wood called it a miracle.
Just because it's down to those last seconds and we come out with a victory. So a win's a win, but it feels good.
Coach Shackelford thanked his boys for yet another win on Juneau's home turf. This is the third playoff game the Mustangs have won in Juneau.
You're welcome, Coach!
Shackelford expected the game to go into overtime. The safety that ended it was a good break.
There was two big he-bulls out here smacking heads all night. I mean, it was a testament to what Juneau does up front really well. We were scheming all week just to see how we could stop those big guys.
On the other side of the field, the Crimson Bears were quiet, except for some sniffs and a coach's encouragement. Interim head coach Rich Soros reminded them the big loss doesn't negate a good season, the Bears' top rank in the Rail Belt Conference, or their relationship with each other.
1, 2, 3,
Dallas! Soros says there was a lot of emotion early in the game, especially for the seniors.
At home, you know, a big crowd, and your last home game ever, win or lose, it's your last time playing on this field. So I think we kind of got caught up in emotion a little bit early on. Then once we settled in and played football, played really well the rest of the game. Probably one of the better four-quarter games that I've ever seen on this field.
The quarterfinal winners go on to semifinal play at Anchorage Football Stadium this weekend. Chugiak plays Palmer, and North Pole takes on Bartlett in the contest between large schools. In small school action, it's Kodiak against Kenai and Homer versus Soldotna. The winners of those games will play in the final championship game on October 17th. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline,
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future,
and by
Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.